In the World Service of the BBC, this is Max Pearson with NewsHour. 60 minutes of news, analysis, and comment from around the world. Hello, the headlines today. Supporters of the Pakistani Prime Minister have stormed into the Supreme Court in Islamabad, forcing the adjournment of his trial for contempt of court.
A member of parliament has climbed the gates of the Supreme Court. Now all the people are trying to follow him.
Is the rabble being used to obstruct the course of justice in Pakistan? The government in Zimbabwe has published the details of its land reform law, provoking a row about the kind of farms it's planning to seize. But the Zimbabwean information minister tells us the move is morally justified.
Our people were robbed of that land at gunpoint, and now we are just giving them back what belongs to them.
An investigation has begun in Britain into allegations of bribery at the world-famous military academy at Sandhurst. We'll be asking if the handing out of gifts has always preceded the passing out of cadets. Also in the programme, the miracle of the frescoes which survived an earthquake. And if you thought moving house was traumatic, try moving an entire government. We report from Kazakhstan. The news today is read by Ian Purdon.
The Chief Justice in Pakistan has adjourned a hearing into charges of contempt of court against the Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif after demonstrators forced their way into the Supreme Court building. They got onto a roof inside the court compound and shouted slogans against the Chief Justice, Sajjad Ali Shah, who abandoned proceedings for the day after an official warned that he was in danger. Our correspondent Phil Goodwin was at the court. We'll have a report from him after this bulletin. The South Korean finance minister Lim Chang-yol is in Tokyo to seek Japan's help in the economic rescue plan drawn up by the International Monetary Fund. Mr. Lim has said his government will need far more than the $20 billion it originally requested from the IMF. Charles Scanlon sent this report from Seoul.
From the outset, South Korea has been pinning its hopes on substantial loans from the United States and Japan to help avert a collapse of its financial system. And despite the opening of negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, it still hopes that bilateral aid will be forthcoming, despite the negative response so far. The finance minister, Lim Chang-yul, is in Tokyo for talks with his Japanese counterpart. He's warned South Korea's neighbors and trading partners that they too could be hit hard by the country's economic problems. But most analysts believe aid will only be given under the auspices of the IMF, which is expected to set tough conditions for a bailout package.
The Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad has said he will continue to resist seeking help from the International Monetary Fund. Dr. Mahathir is quoted as saying that the IMF's tough conditions would hurt local industry and put an extra burden on the Malaysian people. The Malaysian currency and share prices have dropped sharply as a result of recent financial turmoil affecting much of East Asia. The government in Zimbabwe has published its long-awaited list of farms which it's planning to take over without compensation. More than 1,500 mainly white-owned commercial farms are to be nationalised as part of the resettlement programme for thousands of landless black Zimbabweans. The move brought an immediate protest from farmers' leaders. Ian Mills reports from Harare.
The president of the Commercial Farmers Union, Mr. Nick Swanepoel, issued a statement expressing his great concern that the listed farms amounted to a major change in the government's previously stated policy of not wishing to seize productive farms. In fact, Mr. Swanepoel said, contrary to previous assurances of not wishing to drive commercial farmers off their land, the new list contains some of the most intensively utilized and highly productive farms in the country. It was estimated, he said, that if the government went ahead with its current proposals, agricultural production and exports would be cut by 50%. Up to now, Zimbabwe's agricultural sector has been the country's biggest foreign currency earner, at the same time generating two-thirds of the domestic economy.
The Belgian Parliament has approved a law banning all tobacco advertising and sponsorship. The legislation is tougher than was expected after the Senate rejected amendments that would have allowed some exceptions. The law has already been approved by the lower house of parliament and comes into force at the beginning of 1999. The vote comes as the European Union is considering an EU-wide ban on tobacco advertising. The British Ministry of Defence is investigating allegations of bribery at the country's leading military academy, Sandhurst. Seven instructors are said to be under investigation and some have been suspended. They're alleged to have accepted watches and other gifts. Here's Mark Leite.
The MOD confirmed an investigation by military police was launched after complaints from overseas officer cadets that some of their instructors had accepted gifts. Seven NCOs have been accused and it's thought three have been suspended. No further details have been released, but it's thought gifts included items such as expensive watches. I understand the allegations were made by Arab cadets, who said they'd given bribes to instructors and complained later when they discovered it hadn't had any effect on improving their results on the course. Courses at Sandhurst always have a significant proportion of foreign students as a valuable form of military diplomacy to improve relations between Britain and countries with which it has military links. A British military education is prestigious and much prized in most armies worldwide. And although many countries send soldiers of high calibre, some nations send students of distinctly varying quality who have trouble meeting Sandhurst's exacting standards.
President Yeltsin says he'll visit the breakaway Russian Republic of Chechnya in January. Mr. Yeltsin said the trip would enable him to settle the issue of Russian finance to restore Chechnya's war-torn economy and to show support for the Chechen president Aslan Maskhadov. The visit will be Mr. Yeltsin's first to Chechnya since Russia agreed a draft peace deal last year, ending 21 months of war. BBC World Service. Now back to Max Pearson.
Thanks, Ian. There were extraordinary scenes in Islamabad today, where Pakistan's Supreme Court was forced to adjourn proceedings. Supporters of the Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif burst through the gates to the Supreme Court compound, chanting slogans against the Chief Justice, Sajjad Ali Shah. Our correspondent Phil Goodwin was there at the time and sent this report.
Nawaz Sharif's supporters were in a triumphant mood outside the Supreme Court as proceedings began, chanting farewell to the Chief Justice. The party had been dreading this day earlier in the week. A contempt case was due to resume, which could lead to his disqualification as Prime Minister if found guilty. But in the last 2 days, a struggle has emerged between the Supreme Court judges over the Chief Justice, Sajjad Ali Shah. Some Supreme Court judges have ruled that he is suspended from office. And Nawaz Sharif's party, which blames him for the crisis in the country, thinks he's on the way out. The trouble started when one of Nawaz Sharif's politicians clambered from the crowd over the gates to get inside, shouting that he was a member of the National Assembly, or MNA.
A member of parliament has climbed the gates of the Supreme Court. Now all the people are trying to follow him. The gates have burst open and people are now running towards the Supreme Court. The police are just standing by and not doing anything.
A few members of the crowd got into the court building and ran to windows and onto the roof of the entrance. They chanted slogans against the Chief Justice, calling him a bitch. Amid the commotion, a court official ran to the courtroom. A journalist for a weekly newspaper in Karachi, Samad Salik, saw what happened.
A young person, he just entered the courtroom and he said that the Chief Justice is in danger and he should be taken in the custody, security cordon. And then the Chief Justice adjourned the court.
At the same time, news came intensifying the controversy over the Chief Justice. Two of his fellow judges have issued an order in Northwest Frontier Province calling for every Supreme Court judge to meet in the capital on Monday next week to consider the suspension of him. They said that the Chief Justice cannot be part of the hearing. Nawaz Sharif's supporters dispersed, throwing fireworks. They think the government is winning the battle. The future of the Chief Justice is in serious doubt.
Phil Goodwin in Islamabad. Well, even though this latest incident comes in the context of a fairly long-running feud between the Chief Justice and the Prime Minister, it's beginning to look like the old-fashioned use of the rabble to obstruct the course of justice, a point I put to Abbas Nasir of the BBC's Urdu service.
Indeed, yes, it looks that way. But mind you, it's not just pro-Nawaz supporters who were around the Chief Justice in the Supreme Court today. Some of his own brother judges have also ruled against him. So it's a deeper crisis than merely stating that it's street power trying to dictate the course of events in the Supreme Court. However, if the government was aware that their supporters are going to do this, then clearly they were trying to influence the course of events, and hence it can only be said to be very reprehensible.
Indeed, it looks very bad to the outside world, to potential investors. I mean, it hardly looks like the rule of law is being allowed to run its course in Pakistan.
Max, whenever the rule of law has become a victim like this in Pakistan, historically speaking, martial law is just around the corner, which is military rule. I do think that the economy is not in a state where the army would like to take on the reins of the government. But, you know, 20 years ago, General Zia-ul-Haq intervened during a crisis which was far less severe than the one we see today. And even in this one, it seems that the situation is going headlong deeper and deeper into trouble.
And yet the context doesn't appear to be that serious. It's not exactly a constitutional head-to-head going on. It's more of a personal head-to-head between the Prime Minister and the Chief Justice.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I feel very sorry for Pakistanis who struggled for years against military rule to see democracy. And now the Democrats, the people in power who've come through the ballot box, are acting so, if you like, irresponsibly, because after all, they're letting egos come in the way of national institutions.
Just remind us, how has this come about? I mean, what is the row between the Prime Minister and the Chief Justice?
It was first over who has the power to appoint judges to the superior courts in the country. But whilst that debate was being resolved, and eventually the Chief Justice has had his way, it was the Prime Minister and some of his colleagues who allegedly used absolutely unparliamentary language against the Chief Justice on the floor of the House, including saying that his decisions were illegal, unconstitutional, etc., and hence the contempt proceedings. But all that the Chief Justice perhaps would have settled for in the past was an apology. Now it seems that somebody will have to go.
Abbas Nasir of the BBC's Urdu service. The government in Zimbabwe has published its long-awaited list of farms which are to be taken over without compensation. A spokesman for the main farmers' union said the list includes some of the country's most successful farms. More than 1,500 mainly white-owned commercial farms are to be nationalised as part of the resettlement programme for thousands of landless black Zimbabweans. Not surprisingly, the white farmers are angry about the move. The former Rhodesian Prime Minister, Ian Smith, is also a farmer and says it's not just the owners who will suffer.
It's a pretty desperate situation, and there is as much concern from workers as from the owners. Farm workers are deeply distressed because it means they will be out of a job, and agriculture are the biggest employers of labour in this country.
Ian Smith, well, the Zimbabwean Information Minister, Chenhamo Chimtengwende, has been in London today. When he came into the NewsHour studio, I asked him for the rationale behind the redistribution of farms.
This was one of the major objectives of the liberation struggle. And our people were growing very impatient that we had not taken action for such a long time. And if the government doesn't do it, then the people will do it. But it is better if it is done by the government, the acquisition of land, so that it will be orderly, controlled, and would be done in a manner that would not disrupt too many processes in society.
Well, as you know, there are a number of problems associated with the process that is being embarked upon. Almost everyone agrees, for example, that redistributing the land in this way is going to seriously undermine the productivity of that land.
We don't agree with that because the peasants now have about 1 acre per family or 2 acres per family, and that is not enough for their own survival. And we are talking of 70% of the population. And if they can feed themselves, that is productivity. If 70% of our population is given the land and can feed themselves, that is progress, that is good for the country.
But as you know, agriculture feeds into the macro economy of Zimbabwe in a very important way. And if you disrupt the large farms, which do play an important part in the economic life of the country, then you possibly disrupt the economic life of the country.
We don't. And in any case, we cannot say our economy is developing at the expense of 70% of the total population who live in the rural areas. We need them to survive.
Does the government have anything to say, though, to those white farmers who have been farming in Zimbabwe for many, many years? Perhaps their farms have been in a family, have been handed down from generation to generation, who are now being turned off the land?
That was stolen land, and we must recognize that. And anyone who bought that land must have known that he was buying stolen land. Our people were robbed of that land at gunpoint. And now we are just giving them back what belongs to them.
And what if those economists who predict that this redistribution of land will undermine the productivity of the land and therefore feed through into a detrimental effect on the economy of Zimbabwe, what if they are right?
They are not right, and they cannot prove it. We know who they are. They are people with a vested interest, and in fact, we are very much appalled by the way the British media has been reporting on this issue. They are emotionally biased against us because of vested interests. We know that a lot of British people, many British people, are absentee landlords. They have their own land in Zimbabwe, and obviously it affects them.
But isn't it?
They are more concerned with the survival and the future of the white community in Zimbabwe, but not about the future of the majority.
Isn't it also the case that foreign investors and potential donors into Zimbabwe have been holding off from making investment and donation decisions because of this issue of land reform?
That's also not true. We have not done anything or much on this question of land for 17 years, and the investors were coming, or some were not coming. And the investors in any case are not coming to invest in the land. They are coming to invest in manufacturing and in assembling and other economic activities.
The Zimbabwean Information Minister, Chenhamo Chimtengwende. It's just after 13:16 GMT. In a moment, our Central Asia correspondent tests the outdoor temperature in the new Kazakh capital.
It's extremely cold. Winter's just beginning, and I've been here about 5 minutes, but my eyelashes are already frozen.
You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. Quick reminder of the main news today. Supporters of the Pakistani Prime Minister have stormed into the Supreme Court in Islamabad, forcing the adjournment of his trial for contempt of court. The heart of British military training is under a cloud today. It's been revealed that following allegations of bribery, 7 instructors at Sandhurst are under investigation. It's thought 3 have been suspended. The allegation involves gifts apparently made by foreign cadets to instructors. The cadets are subsequently believed to have complained that their gifts did not produce the expected improvement in grades. The BBC's Stephen Diel is himself a former lecturer at Sandhurst, and he's in the studio now. Stephen, were gifts given to instructors in your day?
Well, maybe I should say, first of all, I was never given anything. I think there were occasions when, after the course was over and after the cadets had passed out, because many of them did come from very wealthy backgrounds, they might have given a little gift, a present of some sort, as a gesture of thanks. But I was certainly never aware, and I was there through most of the 80s, I was never aware of anyone being bribed, effectively.
But the issue here is that, as you say, the foreign cadets who are at Sandhurst, and the suspicion that they are of varying calibre in terms of, some of them are the creme de la creme of their home country's military establishments, others might just be the sons of wealthy politicians.
Indeed. I mean, this was always the problem, and it was a problem amongst the cadets themselves. One thing they try and teach people to do at Sandhurst, one of the reasons behind the whole training, is to build up the what they call the buddy-buddy system. You work as a team. Many occasions did I hear complaints both from the cadets and from some of the instructors that some of the foreign cadets simply weren't up to it. You do have to be good. I mean, Sandhurst has rightly got the reputation of being an excellent...
But why does Sandhurst take these people if they're not up to it?
Well, because Sandhurst gets lent on by the British government, basically, because the British government wants to have representatives of various countries who are then going to see it as a good thing that their cadets are trained there, and therefore they're going to buy British tanks, to be blunt. I mean, that's the sort of thing that you don't really say at Sandhurst, because it's stiff upper lip and you're not supposed to say things like that, but that's the reality behind it.
Is there resentment amongst, for example, British graduates and cadets at Sandhurst that there are these foreign cadets there who may not be of a sufficiently high calibre?
Yes, there is. I mean, it's let me make it quite clear. I'm not talking about any sort of racism or anything like that. I mean, they are not resented because they're foreigners. If they're up to speed, then whatever country they're from, they will be welcome. They will be part of the team, and they will be seen as being part of the team. And there are many, many very good foreign cadets have gone through Sandhurst. But if it's thought that they're there because it's for political reasons and they're not really up to the standard they should be, then yes, that does cause a great deal of resentment.
But in this case, it is the instructors, the Sandhurst people, who are being investigated. They presumably should not have accepted the gold watches or whatever it was they were given.
Absolutely not. I mean, it's in contravention of army rules anyway. But I mean, common sense dictates that if you're an instructor, again, it's the best instructors who get chosen. The best sergeants, staff sergeants, sergeant majors, who get sent to Sandhurst to instruct the cadets. And so they know they've got to be good. To do something like this is madness. And I know that this is going to cause real shockwaves. I mean, it would be very interesting to be a fly on the wall of the officers' mess where this very moment officers will be having lunch at Sandhurst. And I'm sure that it'll be either in stunned silence or there'll be a buzz of conversation because they just won't believe it's true.
It's not just shockwaves within Sandhurst. This will send shockwaves around the global military establishment, Sandhurst being so famous.
Yes, it will. It's really is a stunning story.
Stephen Dial, thanks very much indeed for joining us. The government of Kazakhstan has packed up and moved to Akmola, the new capital city inaugurated by President Nazarbayev. Akmola lies in the very centre of the enormous Kazakh steppe, a far cry and more than 1,000 kilometres from the old, more cosy capital, Almaty. Some ministers have already been spotted boarding the train north with electric heaters tucked into their luggage. Akmola is famous for its bitterly cold winters as well as its isolation. Our Central Asia correspondent, Monica Whitlock, reports from Akmola on the move few thought would ever really happen.
I'm standing in the main square in Akmola, surrounded by enormous new buildings that have just been rushed up in the last few weeks. There's a parliament building and a presidential palace, and behind me you can hear the new Kazakh flag fluttering in the breeze. It's extremely cold. Winter's just beginning, and I've been here about 5 minutes, but my eyelashes are already frozen. But today's a great day in Akmola, because it's just become the capital of Kazakhstan. Serik Rustambekov is chief designer of the new Akmola.
В принципе, вот на фотографии с макета вот таким мы представляем будущий.
We've designed a model railway station. The roofs will be red, the plate glass will be blue, and the window frames gold. The walls will be white. That's how we imagine it.
Behind the splendour lies pure politics. The old capital, Almaty, is tucked away in the south. Shifting the seat of power to the centre, Akmola, is meant to secure President Nazarbayev's grip over his vast domain and help build national pride.
Праздник, посвященный приезду этого президента Назарбаева. Честно говоря, мы изображаем страницу казахстанской.
It's a party, a welcoming pageant for President Nazarbayev. We're acting out a chapter of Kazakh history, the Battle of the Yungar against the Sabahs. The Sabahs are the defenders, and the Yungar are a Mongol tribe. Actually, I don't know what we're meant to be doing. I'd like to spit on whoever thought of this pageant.
The idea of nationhood sits oddly with the Kazakhs' nomadic past. Like the steppe itself, the horsemen never knew borders. Besides, Akmola is home to many races, the Russians, Chechens, Ingush, deported here in Soviet times. Andreas Huxak explains how thousands of German settlers were exiled to the steppe by Stalin, who considered them potential collaborators with the Third Reich.
The German people who lived in Kazakhstan, their parents and grandparents have been German, and they stayed here since 60 or 70 years, and they have had an own part for themselves with German schools and German religion and everything in with the German language. And when during the Second World War, they were transported from other parts of the Soviet Union to Kazakhstan or Siberia.
The presidential guard takes its first march around the shining new palace, emblem of sovereign Kazakhstan. Okay, we're going up the steps now. It's covered in rubble. I think they're still building. Let's see what's inside. Well, there's a lot of scaffolding here and marble. They must have put a lot of money into this, you think?
Yes, it is a lot of money who need the government to build a new capital in North Kazakhstan. There's a lot of money which miss the people for their life.
The other Akmola lies just across the street. A yellow-eyed half-wolf guards Juma Beck and Kulban's ramshackle wooden house.
We pensioners. Anna and I.
Juma Beck draws water for tea from an icy outside tap. Like most people here, they're struggling to survive.
Люди вот, извините, нас посадят, наверное, от мусорный ящик некоторые люди.
They might put me in jail for saying this, but people here are scavenging in rubbish bins for food. There was a woman living alone, and she died in her apartment, and no one knew.
Do you think your life is going to change here?
Не знаю, не надеюсь. Сейчас очень трудно. У меня двое детей.
I don't know. I don't have much hope. My two children are out of work. My son, he has a family too. We don't know if the capital will help or not.
Life is so hard, many doubt the ministers on their way from Almaty will stay for long. But Akmola is by no means an unusual city here. The way Juma Beck and Kulban live is common throughout this enormous country, this multitude of races the government seeks to weld together. The peoples of the steppe are resilient, but building nationhood here may take more than parliaments and palaces.
A chilly Monica Whitlock reporting. 9 weeks after the earthquake which devastated large areas of Tuscany in Italy, the famous Basilica at Assisi is set to reopen this weekend. But it's by no means the artistic gem which it used to be. The earthquake created what's been described as the world's biggest jigsaw puzzle when priceless 13th century frescoes crashed to the ground. There are still gaping holes in the ceiling and walls of the basilica where the colourful plasterworks used to be. Father Nicola Giandomenico is the spokesman for the Franciscan monks at Assisi. I asked him about the mood of the community as the basilica is about to reopen.
It's a positive one, of course. And it is also positive for the people from Assisi, because they were looking to the Basilica of St. Francis as a light also for their situation.
But that positive feeling must be tinged with sadness that the Basilica is nowhere near what it used to be.
Especially the upper Basilica. But the lower Basilica is in a good shape. It is as it was before. We are glad for that.
That, in a sense, is quite remarkable, isn't it? That
yes.
Such a tremor left the lower basilica relatively undamaged.
Yes. Someone says it is a miracle. We just say thanks to God because the lower basilica is safe.
But what about the upper basilica and those appallingly damaged frescoes which were left lying on the floor in piles of rubbish? How is the restoration project going?
Right now they are trying to save all the pieces as much as it is possible. And they will begin in the next weeks to look to all the frescoes if by chance they are detached from the walls. Right now, we can see just small damages also on the Franciscan cycle of Giotto. But a better look will be done in the next weeks.
Will Assisi ever be the same again? I'm not thinking of the structure of the basilica itself, but the community.
We hope that Assisi can be better, because the earthquake, in a way, is also a human lesson. And if the people from Assisi is able to understand such a lesson, I think we can foresee the future in a better way.
Father Nicola Giandomenico at Assisi in Tuscany. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Now, South Korea's finance minister, Lim Chang-yul, has flown to Tokyo for talks with his Japanese opposite number to plead for more money to help salvage Korea's economy. For more on that and the rest of the business news for today, here's Sally Hardcastle.
South Korea has admitted that it will need much more than the $20 billion it originally requested from the International Monetary Fund to revive its ailing economy. It's hoping for substantial loans from the United States and Japan as an add-on to the IMF cash. South Korean's finance minister, Lim Chang-yul, will be warning his Japanese counterpart that without further aid, Korea's economic problems could damage its neighbors and trading partners. He's said to want at least another $20 billion from Japan, thus doubling the amount it's hoping to be granted by the IMF. But, according to Richard Werner, an economist at Jardine Fleming in Tokyo, any Japanese money will come with IMF strings attached.
Which means, and that's really the crux, that's what the Americans are after, which means discipline. The IMF wants to implement certain policies, and the trick is, you know, you won't get money if you don't implement those policies, and that is deregulation, liberalization, privatization, opening up markets, and getting rid of bureaucratic controls, having free markets and independent central banks. That's the mantra of the IMF.
Richard Werner. The Venezuelan oil minister, Erwin José Arrieta, has brought new complications to discussions by the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, over new quotas. OPEC wants to increase its quota limit for the first time in 4 years, but Mr. Arrieta, a late arrival at the meeting in Jakarta, says quotas are outdated, and OPEC should be concerned with other matters like globalization and the environment. His cynicism may result from the fact that Venezuela already exceeds its 2.3 million barrel a day quota by 1 million barrels. Indeed, overall, OPEC produces 3 million barrels a day more than its current limit of 25 million barrels. Markets in Tokyo, the Nikkei average rose 33 to 16,636. London's 100 share index is down 16 at 48.72. Currencies, the dollar is worth 1 German mark 76 and 127 Japanese yen. The pound is at $1.68. And that's the business news, Max.
Thanks, Sally. Just after 13:31 GMT is the time. In a moment, another European princess is struck by an eating disorder. And the row over who should represent Hong Kong at the Chinese National People's Congress. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. Right now, we'll get a summary of the latest world news from Ian Purdon.
Supporters of the Pakistani Prime Minister have stormed into the Supreme Court in Islamabad, forcing the adjournment of his trial for contempt of court. Protesters shouted abuse against the Chief Justice, Sajjad Ali Shah, who abandoned the day's hearing when he was warned that the situation could become dangerous. The South Korean Finance Minister, Lim Chang-yol, is in Tokyo to seek Japan's help in the economic rescue plan drawn up by the International Monetary Fund. A finance ministry spokesman in Seoul said he believed that Japan and the United States would assume a significant role in the rescue program. The Malaysian Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, has said he will continue to resist seeking help from the International Monetary Fund. He said its tough conditions would hurt local industry and put an extra burden on the Malaysian people. Farmers in Zimbabwe have reacted angrily to the government's decision to take over their lands. More than 1,500, mainly white-owned farms, are to be nationalised to resettle thousands of landless black Zimbabweans. The country's information minister, Chen Chimutengwende, told this programme that the government was carrying out a long-promised objective of the people's struggle for independence. The Belgian Parliament has approved a law banning all tobacco advertising and sponsorship. The legislation is tougher than was expected after the Senate rejected amendments that would have allowed some exceptions, such as Formula One motor racing. The British Ministry of Defence is investigating allegations of bribery at the country's leading military academy, Sandhurst. 7 instructors are said to be under investigation. Some have been suspended. They're alleged to have accepted watches and other gifts. And President Yeltsin says he'll visit the breakaway Russian Republic of Chechnya in January to settle the issue of Russian finance, to restore Chechnya's war-torn economy, and to show support for the Chechen president, Aslan Maskhadov. That's the summary. Back to Max Pearson.
Thanks, Ian. The Swedish royal family has confirmed that Crown Princess Victoria is suffering from an eating disorder, which has caused her to lose a considerable amount of weight in recent months. A palace spokeswoman said the disorder had been caused by the stress of the 20-year-old princess's increasing public commitments as heir to the throne. She's to be given a less punishing schedule in future. The palace statement was prompted by photographs of the princess at a ball last Saturday, in which she was clearly very thin. Per Olaf Eriksson is the royal correspondent for the Expressen newspaper in Stockholm, the paper which persuaded the royal family to make today's statement.
As I understand it, the family has been discussing this during the week,
And last evening they decided to confirm that the Crown Princess has an eating disorder.
Now, how much are they saying about this eating disorder? I mean, what is it?
They're not saying much about it. They are confirming it. They are saying that they are a little worried about this, and that the Crown Prince is getting the professional help that is needed.
And what is given as the reason? Because eating disorders are often associated with psychological problems. What is being given as the reason for...
The reasons could be she has a very, very tight schedule this last month. She's been in the Riksdag, our parliament. She's been in the government. She's been at the United Nations. She has a lot of appointments during a few months. And that is too tight, that schedule.
Does she look like a woman under
Absolutely
pressure?
Absolutely not. And she is very eager to learn, very ambitious. Too ambitious, I think.
So it's more, the palace is putting it down to more a question of fatigue rather than depression. Because as you all know, there has been a great deal of interest in eating disorders,
yes,
particularly since the late Princess Diana in Britain came clean about her eating disorders.
Yeah, this is one part of it, the tight schedule. She also feels a little stressed about the media interest in her, both here in Sweden and the international press. I think it's both of those things are a part of it.
How will the people of Sweden react to this news? Will they be worried about their princess?
Yes, I think so. She's very popular, you know. Very, very popular. I think that the Republican Association, they can postpone their annual meeting some 40 or 50 years with Victoria as a crown princess.
Per-Olof Eriksson of Expressen in Stockholm. Well, the whole subject of eating disorders, anorexia and bulimia, has been widely debated in the years since the late Princess Diana's troubles were revealed. Often the images portrayed by the fashion industry of skinny models in tight dresses are blamed for creating the impression in young girls that they have to be very thin to be acceptable. Some young people have starved themselves to the point of real illness. Dr. Brian Lask is the director of the Eating Disorders Unit at Great Ormond Street Hospital here in London, and he's on the line now. Dr. Lask, are we getting any closer to knowing more about what it is that really drives young people to starve themselves in this way?
Well, good afternoon. It is a very complicated condition, eating disorders, and there are many different causes that all have to come together at the same time. So someone being very stressed and leading a heavy schedule, that would be one component of the causation, but there are many others as well. And the best way of thinking about this is to consider what are the psychological stresses, and then what are the physical components that make someone vulnerable to developing an eating disorder. It's well recognized that there is a genetic component. In other words, the tendency to develop an eating disorder is inherited.
But certainly you could argue that princesses should be among the most self-confident and self-possessed of all people, and therefore the least likely to be susceptible to ideas of fashion imagery dictating the way they live.
Yes, I think a lot of people do think that way, and it's quite surprising that princesses can get eating disorders. However, one has to also accept the fact that they are in the public eye all the time, that there's a lot of attention to how they appear, what they wear, what they look like, and that in itself, of course, is very stressful.
Is fashion to blame, in your view?
Fashion contributes. There's no question whatsoever that the fashion world promoting thinness as an ideal has played a major contribution to the explosion of eating disorders.
Does this happen anywhere else in the world, apart from in the developed countries where fashion is an industry and is very high profile?
It's a very interesting question, because you find that only in the developed countries do eating disorders occur. In the less developed countries where food is scarce, obesity or fatness is valued, not thinness. What people strive for is to be overweight, because that shows that they are prosperous. In our society, people strive to be underweight because that's equated with beauty.
And what's the answer then in the developed world where the eating disorders relate to thinness? I mean, is the treatment simply to keep people away from fashion magazines and images of thin people?
I think there are two major approaches. One is that the fashion world and the media generally has to be much more aware of the adverse effect that they are having on young, impressionable women. And the second approach that needs to be considered is to help children and I'm talking about young children, school-age children, to learn how to evaluate themselves and their peer group, not on how they appear, not on the fact that they're thin or beautiful, but on other aspects of their personality, that they're clever, that they're fun, that they're interesting, that they're skilled in other ways. So it's about self-esteem just as much as about appearance.
Dr. Brian Last, Director of the Eating Disorders Unit at Great Ormond Street Hospital here in London. In Hong Kong, nominations have closed for candidates to an historic new body. For the first time, Hong Kong is preparing to send its own delegation to China's National People's Congress, the country's most senior lawmaking body. But the process of selecting its representatives has proved highly controversial. From Hong Kong, Jill McGivering reports.
The official opening of the National People's Congress to the strains of China's national anthem. When Hong Kong was under British rule, China appointed a small group of Hong Kong people to attend as part of another delegation. But now, with the change of sovereignty from Britain to China, Hong Kong has the right to choose and send its own representatives. Columnist Andy Ho says it's an historic development.
While Hong Kong has long been suffering from a political identity crisis, after the July 1st handover, this is the first time for the people of Hong Kong to really participate in our own national affairs. So this is the first time that the people of Hong Kong are electing our own representatives to sit in the National Assembly. So in that sense, it is very significant for us.
Hong Kong's 36 delegates are being chosen by an appointed committee of just over 400 people. In theory, any Hong Kong Chinese resident can stand as a candidate, but they need the endorsement of 10 committee members. That rule is ending the hopes of Hong Kong's Democratic Party, which won most seats in Hong Kong's last domestic elections. It's put three candidates forward, but none has got the necessary endorsements. Albert Ho is one of the Democrats now forced to abandon the race.
It seems that the chance, is very slim for people who are pro-democracy, because all those membership, all those people who are in the election committee are very conservative, they are very pro-communist. But yet, we did not wish to see that the election is being held silently and behind closed door.
Other candidates have little sympathy. Chang Dak-sing is the chief editor of the pro-Beijing newspaper Da Gong Bao. He's been a delegate since 1990 and is now trying for a further term. He says the Democrats' failure is a result of its unrealistic platform, which includes a call for the end of one-party rule in China.
The pity is that they have very little contact with mainland China, and I suppose they have very little understanding of what's going on. When they try to run, they put all the candidates in one ticket, and they issue a sort of party platform in which they call for the ending of one-party rule, meaning the end of the Communist Party's political leadership over China. I don't think you can run for the election and hope to be elected on a platform directly opposed to the Chinese constitution.
The most controversial candidate is Jiang Enju, the Hong Kong head of Xinhua or the New China News Agency. A recent opinion poll showed more than 40% of Hong Kong people are opposed to the idea of Mr. Jiang officially representing them. But even so, he's widely expected to be chosen. Commentator Andy Ho.
You have to understand, in the Hong Kong context, the Xinhua News Agency is actually a political organ of the central Chinese government in Hong Kong. So in that sense, I think there is no question at all that the director will get elected. This has actually sent a very bad signal to Hong Kong, because we have been promised a promise of Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong. We are supposed to be highly autonomous in all matters except national defense and foreign relations.
At its recent meeting in Hong Kong, the selection committee seemed distinctly mainland in style, with formal speeches in Mandarin and ripples of polite applause. For Hong Kong, the selection process has clearly reinforced one message: that whatever the Hong Kong public might think, politicians who disagree with Beijing are finding themselves increasingly excluded from Hong Kong's new relationship with the mainland.
Joe McGivering reporting from Hong Kong. It's 13:44 GMT. Still to come in this edition of the programme, we'll have today's sports news and the option of a lifetime on probation for some American paedophiles.
A high-risk situation comes along. That might be where there's some children around. So you have to immediately escape right away. Get away from the high-risk situation.
You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. A reminder of the headlines today. Supporters of the Pakistani Prime Minister have stormed into the Supreme Court in Islamabad, forcing the adjournment of his trial for contempt of court. South Korea is making an attempt to get Japanese financial support as it tries to escape from its economic crisis. And the government in Zimbabwe has published the details of its land reform law, provoking a row about the kind of farms it's planning to seize. At the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa today, Winnie Madikizela-Mandela has been urged to confess any human rights violations in which she may have been involved. This week's testimony before the commission has concentrated on allegations against Mrs. Mandela, who's said to have run a vigilante gang which terrorized the Soweto township in the final years of apartheid. Zakele Mbata was convicted of killing Mrs. Mandela's doctor. This week he said she had ordered him to do it. Mr. Mbata's lawyer is Peter Solier. He told us why this allegation is only being made now, 9 years after the crime.
He's very much aggrieved by reason of the fact that here he is having been given a life prison sentence, and he looks all around him and sees that people who were involved in the same order of things are living it up and driving Mercedeses and fancy cars and living pretty well, when all he did was act on instructions as a young, innocent individual.
Lawyer Peter Solier. Well, the testimony which has come to light this week has been among the most shocking and harrowing heard by the commission. Black South Africans have been forced to reassess their views of the woman who, for many years, was the very embodiment of the struggle against apartheid. Mrs. Mandela herself is due to make a statement to the commission in the next few days. To find out how the Black South African press has been covering the hearings, I've been speaking to Agre Klaste, editor-in-chief of the Sowetan newspaper.
Well, this is probably one of the most sensational stories since the release of Mr. Nelson Mandela. What has happened is that there is a one radio station which he carries it live every day, and most people just sit with their ears glued to the station, so it is the interest is quite phenomenal.
Is there a clear slant in the black press in South Africa? Is it, for example, more sympathetic towards Winnie Mandela than perhaps the white press?
Well, I don't know if you can say that. What the press is trying to do is to report, obviously, what is being said at the hearings. And, I mean, if you talk of emphasis, the white press would probably give more of an emphasis on the fact that she's getting a very hard time. And I think the black press would be much more softer on that line.
How would you assess the perception of Winnie Mandela amongst the people of Soweto, for example? The grassroots was always said to be her bedrock of support. Is that attitude towards her changing?
Well, I don't know if it's changing, you know, because as you might also realize, there are some things being said at the hearing which are pretty silly. I mean, for instance, the thing about Khatija Kadekulu, he was a disastrous witness, and then the kind of evidence he gave in a way swung the support towards Mrs. Mandela. But you're right, there are a whole lot of people, grassroots people, who are still for her. And even the politicians who gave evidence yesterday were not too, I think, hard on her.
But she is being associated with, if not directly accused of committing, more than a dozen murders. I mean, that must surely affect the way black people in South Africa view her.
Yeah, but we're not talking about all black people. Mrs. Mandela has got a support from certain people which I don't think anything will be able to change, short of them seeing her literally committing these things. But there are other black people, obviously, who are most distressed about what is coming out.
Is there any indication, clearly the hearings at the Truth Commission are continuing, but is there any indication at this stage that what is going on is going to have an impact on her continued political ambitions?
I think at the bottom, most people who have the interests of this country at heart would consider it thing of an important measure for her not to continue being in the political situation, because the things that have come out are pretty dreadful.
But if she does decide to continue with a political career in public life, you're suggesting that, for example, in Soweto, there will still be a bedrock of support for her?
Yes, most certainly. And I'm afraid not only in Soweto, but in many other black townships. I know some women in the Women's League, for instance, who obviously knew about all these revelations, although they were rumor in the past, who are still very much behind it.
Agra Klast, editor-in-chief of the Sowetan newspaper. Today's sports news. Now here's Gordon Farker.
And we start with some live tennis action. It's the first day of the Davis Cup final. Sweden, the hosts, are taking on the United States in Gothenburg. In the first of the singles matches, Jonas Björkman is taking on Michael Chang. And for the latest, we can join our reporter at the Scandinavian Hall, Ian Carter.
Well, as you can hear, a terrific atmosphere here for this opening rubber in this Davis Cup final. And it's break point at the moment to Jonas Björkman. And this could be a significant breakthrough because we've been playing for 40 minutes. It's a really closely contested match, this. It's three games all in the first set, and once again Michael Chang is finding himself under pressure. He's already had one service game in which he had to save four break points. He succeeded in doing that in the end, but once again he finds himself under pressure at the moment because it is break point to Jonas Björkman. To follow this match, we have the world number one, Pete Sampras, against Magnus Larsen, but all very close in this particular opening rubber. Chang against Björkman, the rally going on as I speak, and Chang has put it into the net, and the roar you can hear from the capacity crowd here tells you that Jonas Björkman has got the first break of serve of this Davis Cup final, and he leads by 4-3.
Ian Carter at the Scandinavian Hall in Gothenburg. Well, this weekend's First Division football programme in Spain is going ahead as planned, despite a strike by First Division referees. They're protesting at the abuse they claim to have received from players and club officials. The Spanish Football Federation plans to use referees from the lower divisions to control the top flight matches. That could mean that officials as young as 19 might be in charge. The last place in the World Cup finals in France will be decided early tomorrow. Australia play Iran in Melbourne in the second leg of their playoff. The teams are level at 1-1 after the first encounter in Tehran. The Australian goalkeeper Mark Bosnich had an outstanding game in the first leg to deny the Iranians a lead. He says that although the Australians are on home soil, the Iranians are such skillful players, they could have the advantage.
Well, this is the point I've been bringing up here with the local press. Though the pitch wasn't the best in Tehran, it was the same for both sides, and the Iranians had no trouble with it, to be quite honest. So on a good pitch, I suppose, you know, you could turn around and say, well, if they played like they did on that type of pitch, which was very bobbly, but they had no problems with it, what are they going to be like on a good pitch?
And finally, a snooker fan passed the ultimate comment on the game he was watching by falling asleep and snoring so loudly he disturbed the players. The game, featuring two of the world's best, Alan McManus and Stephen Hendry, was being played in London. The snoring was so loud, the players and officials broke up laughing. Afterwards, Hendry said, "It wasn't a great compliment to our game." That's the sport.
Thanks, Gordon. Criminal justice systems around the world have long struggled to find the best way of dealing with paedophiles. It's not so much a question of the length of sentence to impose on convicted child molesters as what to do with them when they're released. In many countries, convicted paedophiles released on probation have been driven out of their home communities by angry parents worried about attacks on their children. In the latest in our series on paedophilia, we go to the American state of Arizona, where a new approach is being tried. It's called lifetime probation. Instead of facing between 10 and 20 years in prison, convicted paedophiles volunteer to take regular lie detector tests and be spied upon for the rest of their lives. Stephen Sacker has been looking at how the scheme works.
All rise. Division 30 of Superior Court of Maricopa County is now in session. The Honorable Michael O. Wilkinson presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Judgment day in a Phoenix courtroom. A man convicted of sexually molesting his 12-year-old stepdaughter. Here's Judge Michael Wilkinson make him an offer.
If there is a prison sentence, the presumptive sentence is 10 years with the Department of Corrections. Instead of prison, you can be placed on probation. That probation can last for the rest of your life. You understand that?
Sex offenders in Arizona are the focus of a unique experiment. Lifetime probation is a sentence from which there's literally no release. But instead of prison, there's weekly counseling, obligatory confessionals, where paedophiles, after years of deception, finally open up in front of other offenders and a therapist.
My target age is emerging adolescent boys, and I found
tons of pictures, sexual pictures, of them on the internet. And even to log into the page and not even look at the picture, but only to look at the description was arousing to me.
So you were willing to risk your freedom so you could look at adolescent boys on the internet?
For a short amount of time, I was.
Can you lean back, put your arms down?
Every offender is required to take regular polygraph lie detector tests. No question is off limits.
Yeah, this test is about to begin. Since your last polygraph, have you possessed or viewed any pornography?
No.
While on probation, have you had any unsupervised contact with anyone under 18 without your PO's permission?
No.
Those caught lying run the risk of seeing probation turned into imprisonment. There are other obligatory tests. Offenders are shown pornography, and their level of sexual arousal is monitored. But the key to this lifetime probation is mobile surveillance. Specially trained officers spend their days spying on sex criminals placed on lifetime probation. Scott Stipe uses an unmarked car. His visits are never announced. It's expensive, but not as costly as jailing every sex offender.
The community wants you to lock them up. That's what they want you to do, but that's not possible. You know, we can't fill up the prisons with the amount of sex offenders we have out there. There's a lot of them out there, and people just don't realize it.
Today, Scott Stipe is checking up on a man convicted of molesting an 8-year-old girl. This is a middle-class neighborhood. The offender is a retired, married professional. On the surface, everything seems normal. But Scott is trained to search for telltale signs of what he calls renewed deviancy. He finds a Keep Fit video and advises the offender not to watch it. Having agreed to the rules of lifetime probation, offenders are encouraged to confront their own problems. This is Ed.
A high-risk situation comes along. That might be where there's some children around. So you have to immediately turn on your strategy, which one would be to escape right away. Get away from the high-risk situation. And avoidance by thinking ahead and realizing that, well, if I went over to the swimming pool at this weekend, there might be some children there. So that's avoidance. And then you should avoid alcohol. You should avoid anything that can lower your inhibitions and make you more prone to, say, commit a problem, commit an offense.
Let's go, Red Hot!
A girls' soccer match in a Phoenix suburb. In the lifetime probation program, sex offenders are not allowed to visit public parks or to go anywhere which might bring them into close contact with children. All over America, sex criminals have to register upon arrival in a new neighborhood. But most parents are unaware that here in Phoenix, an unprecedented effort is being made to manage pedophiles in the community.
From what I've heard, there's not been a whole lot of success either with rehabilitating those people, and that's a concern. You know, now whether you lock them up forever, I don't know what the best deal, you know, what the best solution is there, but manage them somehow, you know, and maybe this is the way. But if they're a serious sex offender, then I personally feel they should be locked up pretty much indefinitely.
Nearly 1,000 sex offenders are now on lifetime probation in and around Phoenix. Millions of dollars in prison costs have been saved. Barely 20 have reoffended. But does that constitute success? Laurie Scott, supervisor of the Phoenix Lifetime Probation Initiative, says that it does.
We're locking up offenders right and left, and I think the public doesn't understand that there are different levels of sex offenders and offenders who can be managed quite well in the community, as we have shown. And if a person goes to prison, there's very little treatment in prison, so they'll sit there for 5, 10, 20 years with no treatment and come out unchanged. And we're in the business of preventing victims.
Laurie Scott from the Phoenix Lifetime Probation Initiative, ending that report from Stephen Sacker. And in tomorrow's News Hour, we have a special report from Britain on the damage done to families forced to live with child abusers. But that's it from this edition of News Hour. This is Max Pearson in London. Until the next time, from all of us here, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
This is London.